This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Before the internet, you would just sit in an armchair with a book open on your lap, staring into space. Or you'd quietly start sketching something in a notebook, not sure what it was, but you'd let inspiration guide you, and then, whoop, turns out you'd drawn a squiggly alligator.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Before the internet, you'd have yawning summer afternoons, when you'd flop down on one couch, then flop down on another, then decide to craft a fake FBI card. You get some paper from your dad's office, copy the FBI logo and your signature, laminate it with scotch tape, put it in your wallet, take it out of your wallet, look at it, then put it back in your wallet with a secretive smile. It was a heady time. You'd be in some kind of art center, wearing roomy overalls, looking at a tray of precious gems, and you'd say, "That's cat's eye." And your friend would say, "No, that's opal." And you'd say, "That's definitely cat's eye." And there would be no way to look it up, except if someone had a little booklet. "Anyone got a little booklet?" you'd ask, looking around. "Is there a booklet on this?" Then you'd walk outside and squint at the sky, just you in your body, not tethered to any network, adrift by yourself in a world of strangers in the sunlight. Before the internet, if you were in need of some facts, you might actually decide to consult an old person, like the one living in your finished basement. But then you'd find yourself watching the bridge on the River Kwai, which you agreed to do because the old person asked in such a fragile way that you couldn't say no. About 10 minutes in, you'd say you needed some water, then wander up to the kitchen where you'd get caught up staring at a refrigerator magnet. Then, for no reason, you'd do a little dance. "Maybe I'll direct music videos," you'd say to yourself. But you'd have no way to look up how to do that. You'd just be standing in the deafening quiet of your kitchen at midday, alone with your thoughts. "Should I test out these pens on this turquoise pad?" you'd ask yourself, staring at some pens by the phone. Instead, you'd take a sip of your drink and say, "Ah," like a person in a commercial. And then you'd go do that in front of a mirror to see how it looked. "Ah." Because that's what it was like before the internet. You made your own fun.
Before the internet, remember? Halcyon Days. That's a piece by Emma Rathbone, performed for us by Jenny Slate. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I think it's pretty fair to say that not many of us had heard much about Antifa before the protests in Charlottesville. Or it certainly wasn't a household name by any stretch. Antifa, which derives from anti-fascist, is a small faction of leftists who are willing to use violence when necessary to confront their opponents. They're the people that Trump was talking about when he referred to violence on many sides. Although at Charlottesville, only one side rammed a car into a crowd and killed someone. Still, the notion that violence can be legitimate, even for a good cause, has a lot of people on the left and on the right very upset. And Antifa has been accused of inciting violence in Berkeley and elsewhere. One of the best ways to get a handle on what the movement means is a new book by Mark Bray called Antifa, The Anti-Fascist Handbook. I spoke with Mark Bray last week. One point you make is that the vast majority of Antifa tactics are nonviolent. Can you explain what some of those tactics are?
Certainly.
We don't see them much.
Right. Well, that's part of the issue, right, is you literally don't see them because a lot of these groups are very secretive about what they do. So certainly a lot of it is essentially thankless drudgery of monitoring white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups on multiple media platforms, trying to figure out who their members are, where they're meeting, who they're working with, where they're trying to hold events, and in many cases, making phone calls or organizing boycotts against venues to try and stop them from hosting these people, trying to contact employers to let them know that their employees are arguing on the internet that Hitler was right, alerting communities that may be under attack. So there is a variety that's done, and quite often there are events that are stopped or shut down before anyone even hears about it. And then you can see that the sort of the level of confrontation is to some extent a last resort when stopping these kinds of events hasn't succeeded. And so that's what sort of needs to be taken into account when we think about what anti-fascism looks like as a whole.
So my understanding is that while there are many liberal groups and many liberal institutions in this country that have been anti-fascist, anti-racist, anti-white supremacist. We're not talking about liberalism here. We're talking about an amalgam of groups that are something else. What are they?
Right. So what you point to is very important. The term anti-fascist, of course, was used for essentially anyone who opposed fascism during World War II. What we're talking about here is a specific pan-radical left politics that is not only about combating fascism, but also has an essentially socialist message. And it has both a revolutionary analysis and a historical analysis, which thinks that some of these mechanisms, whether it be debate, the police, the state, failed in the interwar period to consistently stop the fascist advance, at times even aided the fascist advance, and that's why they argue that direct action is the best method to counteract it.
Well, there's direct action and there's direct action, right? There's civil protests of a kind that we saw in the civil rights movement and in the anti-war movement. And then there are violent protests and a lack of order that we've seen at other times. And research shows us that violent protests, violent riots and uprisings often flip people to the other side. So that in 1968, when you had a lot of violence in the street, you saw Richard Nixon win, not his Democratic opponent. Now, radicals may think that there's really no difference between Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey, but the world may think otherwise. What's your view on that?
Sure. So you're referring to the sort of research around strategic nonviolence, and a number of scholars have debated the evidence to show whether nonviolence and violence works. I think that the first thing to say is that it's often hard to isolate the effectiveness of either strategy because in just about every historical circumstance, you have some manifestation of both tendencies going on at the same time. So, you know, in terms of the 60s, obviously nonviolence was very powerful and very successful, but you also have the looming threat of what happens if these nonviolent protests are not listened to and the methods and the solutions to injustice that they propose are not put into effect. So the threat of a looming race war made certain nonviolent proposals seem more legitimate than they might have seemed otherwise. I'm not sure in the case of fascism, when it comes to power, when it really doesn't respond to public opinion, when it clamps down upon it, if you can always count on purely nonviolent means to leverage that kind of public opinion.
Are you saying that the Nazis came to power because of a lack of will to crack heads in the streets?
No, that's an oversimplification. What I'm saying is that had the Communist Party of Germany, had the Socialist Party of Germany considered Nazism to be a grave threat, several years before it came to power, which it really did not consider to be a grave threat until several, maybe a year or two in, because the slogan of the Communist Party when Hitler took power was first Hitler, then us. So they believed that when Hitler got into power, he would be a fad, he would do such a poor job in government that he would be a one-trick pony and he'd be done quickly.
But hang on, Mark. So let's bring it to the present tense. In your view, what is the nature of the Trump presidency? Is this a fascist presidency in your view?
No, not at all. But I would say that Trump has fascistic qualities. His cult of personality, his glorification of violence, his sort of protectionist opposition to an absolutely free market grounded in sort of an economic and really a subtly racialized nationalism, his xenophobia and so forth, right? And so certainly his connection to the alt-right, the way that he's pandered to a certain kind of white nationalist sentiment, those are causes for concern.
Now, I realize the Antifa movement has other tactics besides anything violent. But the fact is that we have seen things go to violence in various places, including Berkeley. If you have an arsonist in the White House, why hand them the matches? Why hand them the PR victory?
Good question. Well, part of it is to understand that most anti-fascists are revolutionaries and are not specifically concerned about who's in the White House and are as a whole, not necessarily super concerned with what you think about them. But I can tell you why I agree with much of what they say, and you and your listeners can take it for what it is. Certainly, I think most people would agree that there came a point, we can debate when that point was, but there came a point at which self-defense against neo-Nazis and fascists was legitimate historically. And we can see today in Europe and parts of the United States that there are populations who are regularly threatened and attacked by white supremacists, by police who are sympathetic to them. And the legitimacy of self-defense, even in many cases, very illegal self-defense, to me seems like an ethical response to that. And we can see that the way that fascists grow historically can be short-circuited by concerted organizing, and why not do it? So if you look, for example, to the Battle of Cable Street in London in 1936, there was a fascist march planned through the East End of London, which was a predominantly Jewish neighborhood. A lot of the Jewish population there participated with leftists to block the path of this fascist march. Certainly, the majority of British society, which was, of course, predominantly non-Jewish, thought that blocking this march was a disgrace and completely criticized this action in the media. So in the context of the 1930s, if the Jewish population of London wanted to sort of cater to the popular opinion, they probably would have just let the march pass through. But that we can see in the case of Nazi Germany that you can't always rely on the majority population to defend your interests if you're a minority.
In Skokie, Illinois, some decades back, mm-hmm. Nazis marched through the streets of a largely Jewish town.
Yes.
And this was painful to so many people, myself included, and countless other people. Mm-hmm. But there is a freedom of assembly. There's freedom of speech. Isn't that the higher value? It's certainly the higher liberal value.
Certainly the higher liberal value. But the question is, when a certain population is facing a sort of lived illiberalism in the degree to which certain attacks upon them are eroding their actual lived experience of, you know, enjoying rights, when those kinds of values fall apart and you get a white supremacist movement that's targeting people and the majority population doesn't necessarily really care, what do you do about it? You know, so it's sort of a variation. You can look at black nationalism as another example of certain kinds of political formations not trying to cater their politics to what the majority of white people are thinking because they don't necessarily share the same interests.
Do you consider him naive in this sense?
No, not at all. I just think he has a different perspective. I mean, I'm not trying to convince everyone to agree with me. I'm just trying to articulate why this perspective is intelligible.
You know, to my mind, maybe the most dramatic anti-white supremacist moment in American history, and there are many of them, occurred in Selma in 1965, led by John Lewis and others. And people met the dogs and electric cattle prods and violence of white supremacists and the police, it should be pointed out, by peaceful means, by civil disobedience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of blood, and there was a lot of pain, and they won. And they won.
Correct.
Do you think these tactics bring victory, or does it bring more civil strife?
I'm not trying to argue that any tactic is always the best tactic. I'm trying to argue that there are times when different tactics are better than others. And I'm not trying to tell anyone not to do it. I'm just saying that sometimes when you get attacked by armed neo-Nazis, it's legitimate to defend yourself.
Let me ask you this, and I realize you're a scholar of this as well as, but somebody with some sympathies with this. As a citizen not only of the United States, but of Dartmouth, if Dartmouth invited Steve Bannon to speak or Ann Coulter, what would you do about it or not?
Personally, I might write an op-ed criticizing it. I would protest it. But personally, that's probably all I would do, if you're curious.
And for those who would do a lot more and try to do everything they could to prevent their speaking, how do you feel about them?
I think it's contextual. It depends on what is done. I mean, certainly, you know, all politics depends on what's done when by whom. But I think the notion of using civil disobedience methods to stop a speech by Steve Bannon is a legitimate response to that. Sure.
Mark Bray, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Bray is a historian and visiting scholar at Dartmouth College. His book is called Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. After the violence at the University of Virginia last month, colleges around the country began to review applications for events ever more cautiously, trying to balance the obvious claim to free speech on campus against the possibilities of disruption and harm to students. Emotions are particularly high at the University of California, Berkeley, where a conservative student group called the Berkeley Patriot has invited Ann Coulter, Steve Bannon, and the alt-right provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos to campus. It's an event they're calling Free Speech Week. Melissa Murray is a professor of law at Berkeley. She was on campus the last time Milo Yiannopoulos was there and was invited to speak, and protesters smashed windows and set fires. I asked her to describe what that event was like.
So I, at the time, was the interim dean of the law school. One thing they don't tell you when you sign up to be the interim dean is, like the captain of the ship, you've got to make sure everyone's good to go before you leave the building in a situation like that. And so I left the law school building. It was dark. It was winter. And as soon as I drove out of the garage, you could hear helicopters overhead. I mean, just very loud helicopters everywhere. You'd been hearing helicopters all day long, but it just seemed like there were more of them, and it was incredibly loud. And I turned out of the garage onto the road, and there are just people everywhere. And, you know, trying to maneuver your car through these throngs of people chanting and screaming. You know, at one point, you know, people are slamming on the hood of the car, and, you know, people are throwing bottles, like there's glass. I mean, you just don't know what's going to happen. I mean, there were these moments where I just sort of wondered, I mean, am I going to get home in one piece tonight? And, you know, later we learned that a lot of these protesters were sort of coming in from the outside. They weren't members of the Berkeley community.
This is the Antifa or anti-fascist movement.
I guess. I mean, that's what they're called. They're definitely external to the university. And, you know, I think if things had sort of progressed the way that they appeared to have been going earlier in the day, it would have been students sort of expressing discontent, being angry, but not necessarily being violent. I mean, it really tipped over into a different level, the likes of which I hadn't seen. And I will say, if you've been at Berkeley for 12 years, you've seen a protest or two. This was like nothing I'd ever seen.
But you hear this all the time in the media now, not just from conservative commentators, that somehow on campus there's an atmosphere now that people to the left, snowflakes, as they're called, are so sensitive that they don't want to hear from the likes of Ann Coulter or Laura Ingraham or whoever the speaker may be from the right or the Trump right or the alt-right.
Right. I mean, I think that is warranted to some extent. There are certainly students and faculty members and staff and administrators who may be resistant to hearing ideas that are not consistent with their own. But I think
what's their rationale, and do you buy it?
So some people have noted that, especially with someone like Ann Coulter, who I think is, you know, really more of a provocateur than a scholar, that when she speaks, she actually engages in a lot of epithets, making sort of broad claims about different groups that are not necessarily supported by evidence and are, you know, really sort of unkind and mean, and she's doing it purposely. I could see that, but I just want to be clear. I've been at Berkeley for 12 years, and I've seen a number of speakers whose views do not cohere with my own who have come through. Charles Murray came through. The law school's had a number of conservative legal thinkers through our Federalist Society. So this idea that Berkeley is somehow hostile or resistant to viewpoints that don't cohere with some so-called Berkeley orthodoxy, I think, is patently false.
A conservative student group at Berkeley has invited Milo Yiannopoulos and Ann Coulter to speak on campus later this month. It's part of something called Free Speech Week. You're here in NYU for the term.
Yeah.
Is it a mistake for the school, for Berkeley, to host those speakers, given what's happened in the past? The mayor of Berkeley thinks it is.
Yes. I think the administration is really between a rock and a hard place. Berkeley has a very long and deep tradition of being receptive to free speech. It's the birthplace of the free speech movement. I don't really think the administration has a lot of wiggle room here. I mean, if you say that you are for free speech, you have to be for free speech, and that includes even speech that you might find offensive. I do think when these, you know, when free speech tips over into violence, I think that's a moment where the university administration can and should act. And I think it has acted in the past to protect students, to protect demonstrators, to ensure public safety, and to make sure that it doesn't spill over into the kind of things that we saw in February.
You're a law professor. I'm a journalist. I grew up with a certain sense of almost an absolute belief in freedom of speech. Maybe you the same. Do you find that your students are different in some ways when it comes to speech?
There have been a lot of times where I've felt every inch of my 40-something years, right? Like, I'm turning into a stodgy old person.
How so? Because you're hearing what?
Well, so I will give you an anecdote from constitutional law, which I have taught at Berkeley for a number of years now. You know, I had a student a number of years ago come to me and just very, very upset and, you know, of course, you know, what's going on? So-and-so in class said something that it was just so discriminatory and so offensive. And I was sort of racking my brain, what was said in class? I mean, because I usually am pretty attuned to things going, the dynamics of the classroom. And, you know, if someone sort of says something that's really out of line, I will say something in class, like, you know, that's not appropriate. Let's keep it evidence-based. But this student was really angry because we had had a discussion about affirmative action, which I thought had gone very well, given how polarizing that issue can be. And I felt that students ventilated both sides of the argument and were very thoughtful about it. And she was so upset that a student had said that she did not believe in affirmative action. And, you know, she was like, this was so discriminatory. And I was caught off guard because I felt myself sort of, you know, immediately becoming defensive. And I was like, wait a minute, I need you to tell me how it's discriminatory. She's like, well, it means that she doesn't think I belong here. It means that she thinks I don't belong. I'm like, you're personalizing something. All she said was that she doesn't agree with affirmative action.
As a policy.
As a policy. And like, it doesn't have to be about you. Maybe it is, but she didn't personalize it. But like, you know, where is this coming from? And then, you know, we're talking about this. And finally, I just kind of tipped my hand. Like, you may not agree with it. I may not agree with it. But it is a legitimate position that you can take, and it is entirely legitimate
to
raise it in class.
So how is a student like that getting to that conclusion? What has happened in her background in education, and I don't doubt the sincerity of it, that she reaches the conclusion that that speech should not be permissible in a law school seminar?
Perhaps, I mean, it does feel personal. There may be, I think this is true. I mean, I, you know, have felt this as an African-American woman as a student, like, you know, when the day comes to discuss affirmative action and constitutional law, it's like, oh, my God, this is the day where I have to justify being here or, like, show that
there's a sense of dread a little bit.
Yes. And, you know, so I think there was a way in which it was deeply personal to her, and to express opposition to affirmative action was conflated with expressing opposition to her. And, you know, I don't know if it was meant that way. And, you know, maybe it was. Like, she could have been right. But as a professor, I think it's really important that a student be able to say, you know what, I have questions about this. I don't agree with that position. I think this is a legitimate position to have. And, you know, if it's not, help me to understand why it's not.
We're living through a political moment that's charged in a million different ways. Racially is one way. And I wonder how you view what happened in Charlottesville in light of your own experience in Berkeley.
So I'm a graduate of the University of Virginia, so I spent 4 years living in Charlottesville, the last year of which I lived on the lawn, which is the historic part of those grounds that are designed
for
by Thomas
for
Jefferson.
Honored students are placed on the lawn.
Well, allegedly. These are the honored students who don't mind not having a bathroom for a whole year.
Well, you're young.
For me, the year I lived on the lawn, I think I was one of a handful of students of color who were living there. And, you know, I remember that year someone wrote the N-word on my door, and it was such a jarring experience. And to see, you know, 20 years later, people marching with open flames on the lawn, like, what would it have been like for a student of color coming back to the university in 2 weeks and already feeling like, you know, a little bit discombobulated being living in a place that was built by slaves. And, you know, we've only recently begun to acknowledge that contribution at the university, to then be living there having just witnessed this act.
Did the incidents at Berkeley and Charlottesville have anything in common?
Surely, which is, you know, I think interesting because Berkeley and Charlottesville, having been in both places for a number of years, could not be more different in terms of their ethos. I think of Charlottesville and the universities being very pro-institutions. I mean, in Charlottesville, you talk about Thomas Jefferson like he's gone out for ice and he'll be back any minute. At Berkeley, it's very anti-institutionalist, iconoclastic in a way that Charlottesville is not. But yet, I think they're united as being flashpoints for a kind of culture war that I think is coming to a head. And it's a little frightening. You know, in Berkeley, on the one hand, it's this question of free speech and whether free speech can be used to cloak discrimination, bigotry. And, you know, in Charlottesville, it's this larger question of how do we repair a past that for many is deeply uncomfortable and laced with the vestiges of discrimination and segregation, and how do we reconcile that? And I think all of this is sort of united. Like, we as a country have not really done the hard work of reconciling our past, and, you know, we paper over it. But then there are these moments where the wounds come open again, and they're coming open in Berkeley, they're coming open in Charlottesville.
Melissa Murray is a professor of law at Berkeley. We've been talking about the First Amendment, but in a minute, we'll take a look at what happens when it crosses paths with another popular amendment in the Constitution, the Second. That's coming up on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm David Remnick, and welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Demonstrators at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville marched through the grounds of the University of Virginia, carrying flaming torches, an echo of Nazi rallies in the past. And in a modern American touch, some carried assault rifles. Just how and why they were allowed to do that is one of the questions I put to Dahlia Lithwick, the legal analyst at Slate. She hosts Slate's Amicus podcast, and she lived in Charlottesville until just a few weeks ago. Dahlia, I just want to start with Charlottesville, of course. You've lived there for a long time.
16 years. I had both my children there. All the years that I lived there, I commuted to D.C. to cover the Supreme Court, which is not an easy commute, but that's been my home for 16 years.
Dahlia, can you tell us a little bit about the run-up to the Unite the Right rally that took place in August? Talk us through what happened in the city council offices and in the courts in all the days and weeks before this event that really shook the country.
I think, David, it's useful to disaggregate a little bit the controversy about these Civil War monuments, right? We have a monument to Stonewall Jackson. We have a monument to Robert E. Lee. There's been a years-long fight about taking those down, and that's been echoed all across the country with Confederate monuments. That was one piece of it. And then there was this other piece, which is the alt-right and the flaming torches and the Nazis. So the monuments was a story that progressed the way it's progressing in a lot of small southern towns, which is that a high school student wrote a paper saying, I think these monuments stink and they should come down. The city council did this lengthy exploratory, how are we going to do this? What should we do? But ultimately, the city council voted that they were to come down. And a judge in February enjoined that for 6 months and said, there's a statute that says we can't go pulling down Confederate monuments. I'm going to give this some more thought. That's where we were when Richard Spencer and the Charlottesville iteration of Richard Spencer, a gentleman by the name of Jason Kessler, got involved and started to say, we're going to mash our issues into this fight about pulling down the monuments.
How did Jason Kessler come to have a friend in the American Civil Liberties Union?
So this turns in, as classic American stories always do, into a huge court fight. And when it becomes manifest that this rally is going to be out of control, that a lot of people are coming, that this is an open carry state, and that's important, some of them are going to be armed, the city council said, we're going to file a petition to move this thing to a satellite park that's much further away that the police can control. And this litigation goes right up until literally the day before the march. And at that point, the ACLU and the Rutherford Institute, which is another civil libertarian group in Charlottesville, both come together and say, you are persecuting this group based on their ideas and their speech. That's classic First Amendment persecution. And so they side with the Unite the Right folks and Jason Kessler and Richard Spencer and the neo-Nazis to say to the judge, you can't allow this to be moved. And in fairness, and I think this gets lost in some of the reporting, the judge takes really careful notice of the fact that the counter-protesters were not being moved. It looks as though, the judge says, the city is saying only the alt-right and the Nazis have to go to this other site. And so that starts to look a lot like it's discrimination on the basis of viewpoint or ideology, and that's what makes the judge nervous.
So is this not a free speech issue, though? Why is this not a free speech issue? We've seen Nazis and Klan people and all kinds of groups over the years march in Skokie, Illinois, and all manner of places. You don't have to like it. I despise it, but it is a free speech issue, no?
It is, and that's what the judge who looked at this initially just assessed it as a classic speech question.
Was he wrong?
No, I think that he was wrong only insofar as he either didn't take judicial notice or chose not to think about the fact that these folks had guns.
What was your experience of the August rally. Where were you? What did you see?
We were home. We have two boys who are 12 and 14. They were getting very anxious. Everybody was kind of roiling with this feeling of, should I be on the streets? I want to be on the streets, but I don't know how I feel about Antifa. I know how I feel about Antifa, but I don't want to get pepper sprayed. And so everybody was—
Antifa, the anti-fascist group, which made its presence known.
Right. And we should talk about it, because it turns out that when the police stand down in Charlottesville on August 12th, an awful lot of people, including the faith leaders, I talked to many, many clergy leaders, they were telling me, when guys came at me, you know, with clubs and with guns, Antifa saved me. And that's been a part of the story that I think we have to reckon with, too.
Was the speech of counter-protesters somehow suppressed that day?
I think that that gets to the heart of your other question, which is why this isn't a classic speech problem. If you're in an open carry state and people are carrying semi-automatic weapons and they are literally throwing, as they were on the Friday night protest, throwing gasoline and then, you know, trying to light people on fire on the counter-protesting side. And I think this is also really important, David. These were not local alt-right folks. I mean, Jason Kessler was a local alt-right.
Everybody was an import for the most part?
People came. I think that what we were hearing was 80-some percent of the people who came from not even out of town, but out of state.
On the legal side, a key question here has to be this. Is openly carrying a gun a form of protected speech, and should it be?
Yeah. I mean, that's the nut question. And I think it's the question, you know, when you asked me how the judge handled moving the rally, I think the failure was to understand that once folks are open carrying, this is no longer just a speech question. Now, we have speech doctrine, and you cited the Skokie case in the 1970s. The Nazis tried to march in Skokie, Illinois. They deliberately picked neighborhoods where Holocaust survivors were aggregated. The Supreme Court blesses this march, right? And as you said about the ACLU is on the Nazi side, and it destroyed, I mean, Jewish support for the ACLU at that time was really, really eroded.
What do you think of the Skokie case?
I think that the Skokie case was correctly decided because it was a pure speech case. I remember doing a panel about this a year ago with Ted Shaw, who used to be the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And he said the problem when the government gets involved in speech is that they start going after the white supremacists. But you know who gets totally screwed in the end of the day? It's always the black groups. It's always the minorities. It's always the workers. And so you have to analyze
these. How so?
Because the same systemic imbalances that exist throughout the legal system also do not necessarily protect the speech of the people we want to protect. And I take that very, very seriously. I know it sounds deranged in a moment like now, but I think that the last thing any of us wants is the government, particularly this government, to be determining what is protest, who is Antifa, and what is speech. And I think if I had to make one point about the sort of First versus Second Amendment problem here, it's that we can't analyze them separately anymore, that there are folks open carrying in a performative way now. They say, and we've had this all over Virginia.
And you see this on the streets of Charlottesville.
You see, I mean, we had people open carrying in our Whole Foods, like in the banana section. We have our Kroger, you know, is an open carry Kroger. During the 2016 election, there were folks open carrying, again, as kind of performance art, outside one of the candidates' offices, and that candidate's staff were afraid to go home. So I think until we can figure out where the line is between what looks like intimidation and threats and what is simple protected Second Amendment activity, we can sort of say all these speech problems get swallowed into that black hole. And suddenly you have people coming to Charlottesville and they are explicitly saying, I mean, the police knew that they were going to come with guns. They knew that they were.
But my understanding is that firearms are not allowed on the campus of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Did it seem to you that the university was insufficiently prepared for these armed protesters?
So the university is this whole separate drama. On Friday night, this is the 11th, they decided to march on the UVA campus, and they had the flaming torches, the tiki torches, right from the home furnishing section at Walmart.
And that's where they came from.
They were bringing the tiki torches, which, you know, is very, very love boat, but not so love boat when you're a student on campus and you're trying to move in. Now, there are huge factual questions about what the university knew and didn't know. And Teresa Sullivan, who has really had to answer for this in the weeks since.
This is the president of UVA.
She has taken the position, I think not unreasonably, that the university was completely blindsided when it was hundreds of people and they had torches.
How could they not know?
Well, so this is the factual question that is going to have to be unraveled. I think a lot of folks in town already knew that they were going to march on the UVA campus. And this also goes a little bit to this really interesting subset of this problem. You know, we talked about the fact this is a tiny little town. Everybody knows everybody. There's five people on the city council. But I think that the UVA town gown nexus between this college, which was, right, the Harvard of the Confederacy. I mean, this was right. A university that is very much born out of Confederate intellectual. You know, this is Jefferson. This is the heart of what becomes the resistance in the Civil War. And to be blinkered about the history of UVA in this, and that's why I think it's an error to not look at the fact that Richard Spencer and Jason Kessler are UVA alums, that they are still, I think, skating some of this problematic
history. But are you suggesting, wait a minute, that the culture of the University of Virginia at this moment now has traces of this ideology? Either in its faculty or in its students?
Certainly not in its faculty, certainly not in its students. But I think the same failure to absolutely understand what Jefferson means to some people, what Robert E. Lee means to some people, what Stonewall Jackson means to some people. You cannot ask any university, I think, to subordinate its founding, its legacy, and to say, I want you to hate everything about what you were in order to join this century. And so I think that I don't want to by any means say that the university tacitly supports white supremacy. The university did, however, very overtly support astounding KKK and white supremacy activity in the 1920s and 30s.
The ACLU is going through its own drama. It ultimately changed its policy after the demonstration. And that's a historic moment for a group that's 97 years old, isn't it?
The ACLU got so much heat for being on the wrong side of Heather Heyer's death.
But were they on the wrong side of Heather Heyer's death?
Well, that's what they were accused of. That's what you're saying is exactly the right question. And their answer is we had nothing to do with inciting violence.
How were they not wrong?
We were there for speech. I think that they were implicated in what became the legal chaos around the march. I think that they had such acute blowback and membership saying, oh, no, 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 this isn't speech, this is violence. What you are now endorsing is intimidation, it is racial hatred, and this transcends your core mission. And within a day, the ACLU comes out and says, okay, now we're not for that speech. You know, we will now be much more careful about not protecting what looks to be violent threats. And so they received exactly the kind of blowback they got after the Skokie case, but this time they changed their position.
So what needs to change in our legal system to prevent this kind of violent confrontation in the future?
Well,
or is it just lousy policing and bad local politics?
I think the question post-Charlottesville has been, is this the beginning of something or was this a one-off? And certainly Boston suggests, and even what we saw in Northern California suggests, that at least large metropolitan police departments are now going to be very quick to police this in a different fashion. They're going to separate the two sides. There's going to be a huge buffer. You know, there are things we can do, but I think we have a really profound problem with guns, and I think certainly in open carry jurisdictions where Second Amendment folks are taking the position that it is actually a First Amendment right to carry a gun because you are communicating something, there has been a strain of, we can just stand here open carrying with our semi-automatics, and it's just speech. It's just a declaration of our deep fondness for guns.
So tell me about Charlottesville moving forward. I know you've moved to New York, and welcome.
Thank you.
But what happens to your city of Charlottesville?
So Charlottesville is first and foremost still roiled by this, still grieving acutely. My friends who I'm talking to and texting with really are still quite fearful. Richard Spencer and Jason Kessler and all the good folks who joined us in August say they're coming back. This was a huge success for them. And City Council is trying to figure out what went wrong. And as I said, the university is trying to figure out what went wrong. I think a lot of people like me who didn't go out on the streets that day are going to say, maybe I have to go out on the streets the next time.
So what does a place like Berkeley have to learn from something like this? A student group has reportedly invited Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos to speak on campus. The last time Milo was there, violent counter-protesters set fires and destroyed buildings or damaged buildings, and the university was forced to cancel the speech. How do you view the Berkeley phenomenon?
I think that it's a totally different and inapposite set of problems, and I think we have to kind of analyze them differently. I'm going to continue to say on this, I am a free speech purist, that the cure for bad speech is more speech. You know, as Justice Brandeis said, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And shutting down speeches and speakers doesn't make their ideas go away.
Dahlia Lithwick, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor and legal analyst at Slate. Coming up, we're going to take a break from politics. You're welcome. We sent staff writer Susan Orlean to an origami convention, no kidding, to try her hand at some very advanced techniques in folding.
Here's where we were. I'm going to bring this raw edge to line up with a diagonal existing crease. As I do that, I'll have to make a squash fold of the layers in between, squash that, and flatten.
I should have had more coffee.
That's coming up in a minute on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
At 94 years of age, I'm blind in my right eye, deaf in my left ear, have a broken hip. But I have to tell you, origami is the best medicine. I never take a painkiller. All I do is take a piece of paper and I get very absorbed. And depending
earlier
on
this summer, the Origami USA convention was held here in New York at St. John's College in Queens. Hundreds of aficionados gather to talk shop and learn new designs for folding paper bugs, birds, furniture, even a trombone.
I play the trombone, and so I designed an origami trombone with a moving slide. And so, you know, I'm going to be teaching that here at the convention. It's a complex level design.
An origami trombone. Couldn't resist, so we sent staff writer Susan Orlean to cover the convention. Now, Susan jokes that her beat for The New Yorker has always been maniacs. She's written about umbrella inventors, about two guys who impersonated a Twitter bot. Long story. And she also wrote an epic story about an orchid thief that became the basis for the movie Adaptation. Here's Susan Orlean.
I always love reading about and writing about people who are inordinately passionate about something, which is kind of a nicer way of saying people who are obsessed. So, of course, I love origami people. But I went to the convention to see one origami person in particular, a Caltech-trained physicist named Robert Lang. Robert had been doing cutting-edge research in lasers, but then at the peak of his career in physics, he gave it up to become a professional origami artist. Every origami fan at the convention wanted to be in a class with Robert. He's the Da Vinci of origami. Maybe he's the Obi-Wan Kenobi of origami. Maybe he's the Secretariat of origami. He was teaching a session on a model of his called the Taiwan Goldfish. It's Opus 716 in the oeuvre of Robert Lang.
This is Robert Lang. He's going to be presenting his Taiwan Goldfish. Thank you, Robert.
You're welcome. So are we ready to go? Okay. I'd already told the folks here we're using 10-inch foil-backed paper. American foil, alu foil.
Over the years, Robert Japanese has folded flat sheets of paper into an unimaginable array of things, including rhinoceroses, cuckoo clocks, unicorns, nearly every kind of beetle known to mankind, and in one of his most famous demonstrations, the head of Drew Carey.
There was a plot line where Drew Carey took up origami, and they said, well, we want him to fold a big origami model of himself, so would you fold a life-size Drew Carey? Which I did, but they rewrote that out of the script, so it never made it to air, which is sort of too bad.
Now, I am the lowest level of origami artist. In fact, I really shouldn't even dignify myself by calling myself an artist. I like folding paper. Normally, I would not be the target audience for Robert's class.
So, let's get started. And we're going to start with the color up and fold the paper in half from edge to edge.
This was step-by-step instruction on how to fold Robert's Taiwan goldfish. It's this really beautiful creature with a hinged mouth, a long, elegant tail, and all the proper goldfish fins trailing off in a kind of poetic way. And it's really hard. So hang on, don't go so fast.
And bring it back.
So I cheated. I was sitting next to a friend of Robert's, another professional origami artist, and he kept leaning over and helping me fix my mistakes.
Here's where we were. I'm gonna bring this raw edge to line up with a diagonal existing crease. As I do that, I'll have to make a squash fold of the layers in between, squash that, and flatten.
I have a little bit of a flaw. What's wrong here?
There's a little close-up. There's the crease. Fold it over, and I squash fold the little hood, and then press it flat.
There is a problem.
And we're ready for our next step.
I mean,
the next step is going to be...
Origami is an ancient art form that nobody would ever describe as a growth industry. But we're also now recognizing that it has enormous technological potential. In fact, in 2012, the National Science Foundation awarded millions of dollars for research into the scientific applications of folding.
And this gave a huge jump start to the field. There have been all of these applications that people have demonstrated using origami and solar arrays and airbags and telescopes and things like this. And this is something...
One of the really cool ways origami is being used now is as a foldable Kevlar bulletproof barrier for police to use.
So it's 12 layers of Kevlar, and you grab it, and it unfolds and creates this sort of arc-shaped barrier. Because it's folded from one sheet with no seams, there are no weak places.
There are also breakthroughs in origami that are pretty extraordinary and very experimental, like the recent development of the world's tiniest origami bird.
It's about 400 microns long, about 5 human hair widths in size, and this was done with photolithography and chemistry to induce the paper to fold itself into the bird.
That's amazing. you know, obviously nobody can look at a bird that big and say, oh, you know, look at this. I mean, it's too small to actually...
Yeah, you need a microscope to make out the bird.
Yeah, so partly you're doing it for the physics of learning how to make something like that happen.
Yeah, there's no actual application for a bird, but the technology of creating self-folding microscopic paper has applications, particularly in making medical devices. Microscopic machines that can sort cells or, you know, can go crush a cancer cell but leave non-cancer cells alone and things like that. But when you're demonstrating milestones along the way, you pick something that looks fun and cool. The next step is going to be a crimp. Crimp is
deformed
valley.
Goldfish.
The mountain exists. The mountain fold is this vertical crease that we made early on. The valley fold's going to run out in this region.
Is there something innate that would make someone good at origami as opposed to just being studious?
It's hard to put a finger on precisely what it is. But to be really good at origami, you need to be able to visualize what the paper's doing and visualize kind of what's going on inside a stack of layers.
You know what I just thought of? This might be ridiculous, but I wonder if people who are good at origami would also be good at cutting hair, because it's three-dimensional and it's lots of layers. And I have to research that. But it's just,
you know I don't know any haircutters who come to the convention.
I'm drawing this connection because I'm really bad at cutting hair, much as I always love to cut, like, my boyfriend's hair. And I'm also quite bad at origami. And so I think there's a connection.
Now, in origami, if we mess up, we throw it away, grab a new sheet of paper. You have to have a little more care and precision when you're cutting someone's hair.
You get a new boyfriend, which is what I
just
did.
Just get a new person. Here's a little bit stretched out. You can see this side is half of a reverse fold. Gonna do the same thing on the other side.
I should have had more coffee.
I remember when we first met, you said something to me that I've never forgotten, that paper has a memory, that once you fold it, you can never entirely remove the fold. Am I remembering this right?
Yeah, once you made it, you folded it, the paper has a memory because the fibers and the bonds between the fibers are permanently changed, and so it'll always know that fold.
Well, it's funny because it's something that I think about often, because there's something kind of profound about it. It seems like it's kind of about life too.
Yeah, the engineers have a way of, you know, reducing a profound concept to a technical term. It undergoes plastic deformation. It just means a permanent change. And lots of materials do that as well. If you take a sheet of metal and you fold it and then you try to unfold it, you'll be left with a little divot that you can't really get rid of. But paper, yes, it remembers that fold, but then it's also happy to fold the other direction. And that is unusual.
It's really cute.
And the very last regular fold, I'm going to open it out and reverse fold it forward so that, there we go, you get a mouth. That is the mouth.
That is.
And once you have the mouth, then you can put your fingers inside, round the body, and bring the fins out. That's our finished goldfish. And our visitor was successful. It looks like so.
Well, with a little help.
Staff writer Susan Orlean with the origami legend Robert Lang. And that's it for the New Yorker Radio Hour this week. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining me. Next week will be our 100th episode. 100. Who knew? Talk to you then.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythali Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Terrence Bernardo, Sarah Sandbach, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.